Good morning. On today's show, we look at why closing Guantanamo Bay is proving so difficult for US authorities. And paving the ways at the Rack Rocks, we'll be looking at how a major carbon extraction project in the United Arab Emirates may have the potential to be an environmental game changer. But first, we look at the UK election. The country has abolished its 15-year absence rule to vote, and it means that British people living abroad will be able to cast their ballots regardless of how long they have been out of the country. It's estimated that around 3.5 million people who live overseas will now be able to have their say, and it has led to some interesting new voters. One of those is a woman in Los Angeles who hasn't lived in the UK for 60 years. Alice Hutton has been finding out more.
When Claire Sassoon left High Wycombe for Los Angeles in 1964, aged 3, Harold Wilson was Labour Prime Minister. The death penalty was finally being abolished, and Mary Poppins and My Fair Lady were in the cinemas. 60 years later, she has finally registered to vote in the UK's snap general election, despite still living 5,000 miles away in America. The grey-haired 63-year-old British-American grandmother is one of 3.5 million overseas Brits who were quietly enfranchised by the Electoral Commission in January following the Election Act in 2022 that finally lifted the ban on voting after a 15-year absence. It's one of a raft of new rules around elections, including the need to show ID at the polls. While many of the changes were welcomed by voter rights groups, some were concerned that it would allow long-time overseas voters to meddle in British politics without suffering any of the consequences. Sassoon isn't listening to that. "I'm so excited," she says, "for me, but also for all the formerly disenfranchised voters. I've been a lifelong voter. It's very important to me." She's one of the estimated 700,000 British citizens living in the US who qualify. But after a lifetime away from the UK, raising 3 daughters and now helping to care for her 2-year-old granddaughter, she only applied for her citizenship and passport in 2017 when she was encouraged to do so by her children. Then, hours after news of the election was announced, a friend rang to tell her of her new rights, and she rushed to find a computer to sign up before the June 18th deadline. With help from a relative still living there, she will now vote via a proxy in the Wickham constituency in Buckinghamshire, where Conservative MP and Northern Ireland Secretary Steve Baker sits, on July 4th no less, a day celebrated in the United States as Freedom Day, or the day the Founding Fathers signed the Declaration of Independence from the British. 4 months later, the American citizen will also be voting in the 2024 US election. The irony of it all is not lost on her. Sassoon may be a California native, but she also stresses that she has deep British roots. Poetry fans may have heard her surname and wondered. Yes, she is a distant cousin of the First World War poet Siegfried Sassoon, whose poems on the horrors of the Western Front are famous across classrooms in England in particular. And they talk of the need for peaceful transitions of power, less damaging political propaganda, and the rejection of the sword in favour of the pen. Something that will be front and centre in Sassoon's mind when she reads the Wickham local candidate's statements and makes her careful decision. As a lifelong Democrat, it may surprise some to learn that Sassoon is also related to another famous Briton, the Conservative peer and former Treasury Minister Baron James Sassoon, who sits in the House of Lords, and who was mentioned in the Paradise Papers in 2017 for being the beneficiary of a $236 million trust in the Cayman Islands. They met once, apparently, and found that they didn't have much in common. Will she get in touch? No, she says. I don't think I'll tell him I'm voting. This is Alice Hutton for World Report.
Next, we go to the United Arab Emirates, where world leaders gathered last December and signed up to a historic deal that was touted as the beginning of the end for fossil fuels. The COP28 summit saw world leaders commit to reducing their greenhouse gas emissions as well as give financial support to nations that are more vulnerable to the effects of climate change. One of the ways that the UAE itself is aiming to cut down its emissions is by investing heavily in carbon capture and storage. It unveiled one major project during the summer last December, and Connor Power has been checking in to see how it is progressing.
The United Arab Emirates, or the UAE, is a federation of seven emirates, all of which have been ruled by absolute monarchies for centuries in a largely peaceful and progressive manner. The oil-rich emirates of Dubai and Abu Dhabi are by far the most famous of the seven emirates in the federation. Ras Al Khaimah, or RAK as it's colloquially known, is located 100 kilometres north of Dubai. Much quieter than its brash oil-rich neighbours to the south, it has towering mountains and a sandy coastline. Billing itself as the Nature Emirate, tourism is its most important sector, along with heavy industry such as armoured vehicle and cement production, as well as having one of the largest ceramic factories in the world. The rock in Rak plays a very important role. In the first instance, the Emirate's enormous mountains that rise to over 2,000 metres attract tourists who indulge in mountaineering and hiking, as well as ziplining and tobogganing. Its rock was also used to create the famous Palm Islands in Dubai. The next role for Ras Al Khaimah's rock, however, is likely to be an even more important one. With the Emirates' unique geology bringing its centre stage in a CCS, or Carbon Capture and Storage, programme. If current tests are successful on a larger scale, then this form of carbon capture and storage could have significant benefits for the Emirate and for the rest of the planet. In the world of CCS, it's all about scaling up and seeing which of the variants of this nascent technology actually works best, so that they will become the most cost-efficient in the fast-approaching future. At the moment, it seems that DAC, or Direct Air Capture, is leading the charge, as evidenced by the news that the world's largest DAC plant, called Mammoth, is being built in Iceland by Swiss company Climeworks. Here in Rak, South African national Chris Wood is chief executive of the Rak Petroleum Authority and head of a project of CO2 extraction and storage in the rock of Ras Al Khaimah. According to Chris, they are very fortunate in Ras Al Khaimah to have a specific type of rock, which is a deep mantle rock that comes to the surface, high in mineral content containing iron and magnesium. It's basically taking nature's process and solidifying the CO2 in the rock structure, says Chris. They know it works because nature has already been doing this for billions of years, visible in white irregular streaks of calcinate carbon dioxide in the rock. The process is speeded up by injecting CO2 directly into the rock in a cryogenic liquid state, allowing carbon dioxide to be effectively captured in a process of mineralization. The fortunate thing about RAK, says Chris, is that not only do they have the right rock in the Emirate, they also have a lot of the right kind of heavy industry nearby. Ceramic, cement and vehicle manufacturing, which is producing a lot of CO2 from the manufacturing and heating processes. The CCS process involves capturing the substantial carbon emissions that these industries produce and transporting them a relatively short distance of 60 to 70 kilometres away to be stored in the RAK rock. Right now, this is still very much at the data acquisition stage, with small amounts of CO2 being extracted from a large cement factory near Ras Al Khaimah's port. If all goes well, however, over the next few months, they'll be looking to scale up the process over the coming couple of years and then repeat it for other industries, drilling 2 to 3 kilometres into the rock where the CO2 will be stored without causing any damage to the rock structure. The project was unveiled recently at COP28, the UN Climate Change Conference, which was held in the UAE just down the road in Dubai last December. The UAE is not the first place in the world that you'd associate with positive action against climate change. But they have been worried about energy security for a long time, and CCS is part of that equation. There is no alternative, says Chris, and you can already see billions of dollars being invested by the Middle East in all these technologies, from solar panels to CCS. We're very much an energy-focused region, as opposed to an oil-focused one. If the billions being invested turns the scientific theory into large-scale practice, the rugged mountains of the UAE's Nature Emirate could lead by example in the increasingly desperate global race to reduce carbon emissions. For RTE World Report in Ras Al Khaimah, UAE, this is Connor Power.
And finally, on Thursday, a US military jury sentenced a longtime Guantanamo Bay inmate to a 30-year prison sentence. Former Al-Qaeda commander Abdul Hadi al-Iraqi has been held at Guantanamo since 2007, and he is one of 30 men who are still being detained there. President Joe Biden's administration says it remains committed to closing the facility after 22 years, but with only 2 months left in his term, there are doubts about whether he will be able to achieve this. Reporter HJMI travelled to the base this month to see firsthand why closing it has been such a challenge.
There's a tiki bar, a dive shop, and several pristine beaches. The first impression after arriving at the US Naval facility in Guantanamo Bay is that of a Caribbean resort town rather than that of a strategically important military base. The US military installation in southern Cuba has been around for over 100 years. It was first set up after the Spanish-American War in the late 19th century, but it only became a household name after the attacks of September 11, 2001. Former U.S. President George W. Bush and his administration were looking for a place to put alleged terrorists captured during the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. They settled on Guantanamo Bay after arguing that neither U.S. nor international law would apply to the detainees held there. Over the course of the past 22 years, the U.S. government detained close to 800 Muslim men at the facility. Most of them were never charged with a crime and transferred back to their home country or a nation willing to take them in. One of them was Mansour Abafi, who arrived at the facility at the age of 19. He was accused of being an Al-Qaeda recruiter, but the U.S. failed to gather up any evidence to support his claim. He spent over 14 years at Guantanamo before being transferred to Serbia in 2016. Abafi says he spent his 20s surrounded by torture, abuse and mistreatment, something that has been confirmed by U.S. government and independent reports. Guantanamo's unclear legal status has been the center of many court challenges. To trial Guantanamo inmates, the U.S. set up a military commission. For Scott Ream, director of global policy and advocacy at the Center for Victims of Torture, Guantanamo and the military commissions are unlawful. He believes that trying the man accused of planning and executing attacks against the U.S. and its allies within the U.S. legal system would drastically increase the chances of achieving justice. The issue, as Ream explained, is that many confessions were obtained through torture, which would not be admissible in federal U.S. court. But even without the constraints of the U.S. justice system, the military commission has only been able to return 9 convictions, most of them through plea deals. Despite this concerning track record, Republicans in Congress want to keep Guantanamo open. Former U.S. President Donald Trump has even said he wants to fill the facility with, quote, bad dudes. The U.S. military is aware of Guantanamo's negative reputation and has put strict limits on journalists' ability to cover the story. Taking pictures of the detention facility or the legal complex on base are prohibited. Speaking with military members without prior approval is also not allowed, and even official statements are hard to come by. Guantanamo has stained America's human rights record over the past 2 decades. Adversaries like China or Russia use Guantanamo regularly to push back against U.S. allegations about their country's respective human rights violations. Closing Guantanamo requires enormous political capital, something that former President Barack Obama didn't have, and President Biden seems unwilling to exert during an election year. Inmate Hadi Al-Iraqi pleaded guilty in 2022 for his role in attacks against U.S. and allied troops during the early part of the War on Terror. His 30-year sentence has been reduced to 10 years after a previously negotiated plea agreement. But even after his sentence is up in 2032, there's no guarantee that Hadi Al-Iraqi will ever leave Guantanamo. The U.S. has been trying to find a country that would take him, but has been unsuccessful so far.
The search is further complicated due to a degenerative spinal cord condition, which limits his movements and requires extensive treatments. Any country willing to accept Hadi Al-Iraqi would be required to provide this medical care. Human rights groups continue to fight for the closure of the detention facility. But some say that only when the last prisoner has died will this dark chapter in America's history come to an end. For World Report, I'm HJMI in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba.
And that's it from World Report today. If you want to listen back, you can find the show at rte.ie/worldreport or wherever you get your podcasts. We'll be back at the same time next week. So for myself, Gavin O'Callaghan, and all of the team, have a good weekend and take care.